Good evening.
Good evening.
Good to see you all here tonight. Hope you've done well this week so far. Avoided falling on the ice and all that sort of thing. A good part of it's melted, which is nice. We'll be ready for some more by this weekend, won't we? Well, tonight I want to clean up a little bit from last Wednesday night. I realized after the fact that I had not really presented the reasons, the understanding behind the claim that verse 44 of John 6, which goes something like this: "No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day." You may remember last week that I suggested that the drawing that Jesus is talking about, or what he means by that expression, is not what it seems like in just that English translation. That seems to suggest that you can't come to Jesus physically or in any sense unless God directly facilitates it. But rather what he's referring to is come to him when he goes back to heaven. That transition is a gulf that we have no way to get to. And so that is not immediately apparent why I think it's true just by reading this, and I want to give you a little more on that. Now, why is this verse so important? Well, this verse is important if you ever come into a conversation with Calvinists. This is a big proof text which is dropped as proving that the only people that can be saved are the ones God's picked out, and you can't even come to Jesus unless God draws you in a specific, individual, personal way. Something that we're going to have to go back to the beginning of the chapter to get into this. Now, John is often perceived as being simple in his presentation of the gospel. His Greek is fairly simple, and many of his verses are short statements that just seem simple. But the fact of the matter is that he has a complex mix of threads in his narrative. And I'm going to try to show you some of those tonight. And there's a word that has come to mean new things with the advent of the internet and technology. A thread used to be a thread, right? It's something that you have in your clothes or hold your clothes together with and hold your buttons on, those kind of things. But now we have, many of us I think probably have become used to thinking also of a thread being a separate line of conversation, a separate topic perhaps, and something that's based on a given question or perspective. And so this is a multi-threaded narrative that John has going on here. And if you don't follow some of those threads, then Jesus doesn't make much sense. So let's look here and see what's going on. We've got a number of things already happening here. In chapter 5, we had the healing of the gentleman who had been lame and couldn't get up to go into the troubled waters at the pool of Bethesda. And Jesus told him to get up and take his bed and walk. And it was on a Sunday, and so that got him bad press all the way around. But that goes on into a conversation, and one of the things that he says in that conversation is that, "Search the Scriptures," verse 39, "for in them you think ye have eternal life, and they are they that testify of me. And ye will not come to me, that ye might have eternal life." Okay, so that's a complaint, that's an accusation, That is a statement about the status of those who are his opponents. He says, you will not come to me. And that word there, will, is actually a word which expresses the will, what you have will to do. And so already we have a situation where if Jesus believed that you can only come to him if God makes it happen, he wouldn't be complaining that people would not come to him, that your will is what's involved here. Okay, so don't ever let people jump you in the middle of a chapter to pull out a cardinal doctrine that they're going to build everything around, because there's a much bigger picture here. But then we get out here into chapter 6. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias also called. And a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased. And Jesus went up into a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. Okay, so John drops that in there, doesn't do anything with it, but gives you the time of the year, approximately. It would be in the springtime when this happened. When Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company coming to him, he said unto Philip, whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? This he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Okay, so Jesus looks up, sees all these people. What's the first question that comes to your mind? Probably not, where are we going to buy food to feed all of them? But Jesus had something in mind here to demonstrate to his disciples who he was. And Philip said, well, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient for them that every one may take a little. Okay, so this would be about 200 days' wages. So 6.5 months. 6.5 months of earnings wouldn't buy enough bread, he says, to even give everybody a little bit. So he wasn't going to lose anything here on wagering as to how much it would take. He just says it's not going to be easy, and that much wouldn't even get us started. One of his disciples, Andrew, who's Simon Peter's brother, saith unto him, there's a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? Okay. And Jesus said, make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them which were set down, and likewise of the fishes, as much as they would. So apparently they managed to talk the little boy out of his food and used it to distribute among all the people. When they were filled, time out, and likewise of the fishes, as much as they would. Now you might think that's saying they handed them out as far as they would go, but that's not what that means. As much as they wanted. They kept handing them out until everybody had all they wanted. That's the point. And when they were full, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. Therefore they gathered them together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which remained over and above unto them that had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world. Okay, so the Jews were looking for a Messiah. They conceived of the Messiah that was to come as a son of David, and as such, one who would restore to Israel the grandeur of the kingdom of David. And in particular, at this point in time, they were concerned with getting rid of the Roman overlords that were in control of the country. And so that's what they had in mind by looking for the one who was to come. And this next verse is important, verse 15. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. Now, I think that really is a key verse to understanding the dynamic of what's going on in the verses that follow. The people had determined this guy has got the ability to change things in this country. He's got connections that clearly are divine. He seems to be a fulfillment of what we're expecting, and therefore we will force him into this position, into this role. Okay? Have you ever felt like you were in a position where somebody looked at you and said, you know, you're just what I need. I've got a job for you. You like that feeling?
No.
No. Just naturally, that's not something we tend to like. We don't like to be used. But you can only imagine how God in flesh would have felt about human beings looking at him and saying, we've got a job for you, and we're going to put you on the throne, and you'll do what we would like you to do. And so he had a way of disappearing, and it just says he departed. Why they didn't follow him, I don't know. He went up into the mountain. Maybe it was too steep. They didn't want to climb. But at any rate, he didn't make himself available for their wishes, but he left. And when even was now come, his disciples went down unto the sea. And remember, this is the Sea of Galilee. And you remember from our earlier studies about how big that sea was, not so much in miles, but compared to some body of water around here. Does it compare to anything we have in southern Illinois?
Like Carlisle.
In general, yes. About that size. It's wider, I believe, and deeper by a whole bunch. In general, deeper by a whole bunch. It's not forever to the other side. In other words, it's not like the Atlantic or the Mediterranean even. So it's possible to get around it without too much loss of time, although sometimes it's much quicker to take a boat and go over it. At any rate, the disciples came down and entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not come to them. And the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing nigh unto the ship. So he was quite the walker, because he was going faster on the water than they were going through it. Of course, maybe the wind was against them, but he caught up with them, and they were afraid. But he said unto them, it is I, be not afraid. Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately the ship was at the land whither they went. Sorry, Larry's not here tonight. He was very intrigued by this passage. He mentioned it to me, I think, last Wednesday night, how that Jesus could make a ship fly. Because it says immediately he was on the other side. Okay, follow the narrative here. The day following, when the people which stood on the other side of the sea, that is, where they had been fed, saw that there was none other boat there save that one whereinto his disciples were entered, and they saw that Jesus went not with his disciples into the boat, but that his disciples were gone away alone. And then this language is awkward, but basically verse 23 says, however, after they left, there were other boats that came. And that's so you don't wonder whenever it says that they got into the boats and left, because if there were no other boats, then what did they leave in? So John's just telling you, but there were some other boats that came after the disciples left. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, neither his disciples, they also took shipping and came to Capernaum, seeking for Jesus. And when they had found him on the other side of the sea, they said unto him, Rabbi, when camest thou hither? Okay. Now keep in mind, these are the same people who in their own mind had decided that they needed to make Jesus king. And he disappears. They see that he didn't get in the boat, but he's back on the other side when the disciples are there. And they're pushy. They're on his track again. How'd you get here? When did you come? Now, Jesus doesn't respond to that in a way that they wanted. He basically ignores that. But keep in mind, that's what's on their mind. He says, Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me, not because you saw the miracles, but because you did eat of the loaves and were filled. Swallow hard. Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed. And that's just a word which means mark. Then said they unto him, okay, so he's diverted them from what they ask him, and they're on to something else. What shall we do that we might work the works of God? Okay, now, it may surprise you that they asked that, but that's because of, in the translation here, we've lost some of the language. Jesus said in verse 7, work not for the meat. It's translated labor here. So he brought up the concept of working. And so then they say, okay, what do we need to do to work the works of God? So they're responding to his language with this question. Jesus answered and said unto them, this is the work of God, that ye believe on him whom he hath sent. Now, if Jesus knew that they were not capable of believing on him unless God specifically selected them for the job, wouldn't this have been a good time to say it? This is, they ask him, what are we supposed to do? What are the works that we're supposed to do? This is the work, that you believe on him whom he hath sent. They said therefore unto him, what sign showest thou then that we may see and believe thee? What dost thou work? Now, it's clear here to an honest observer that these folks are not intent on serious truth finding. These are the same folks that were fed just on the other side of the sea. And they say, what sign are you going to show us that we'll see and believe? They have their own agenda. They are wanting to press him into service. And they are humoring his language for the moment to find a way to get what they want. Keep in mind, they followed him back across the sea in pursuit of him. They came to him seeking to continue what it was they wanted to do. And they engaged in this conversation. Jesus stays just out of their reach. He avoids the first question. He redirects their attention to the kind of issues he wants to talk about. But throughout this, he says various things which are intended to distract, knowing that they aren't serious. And so, many of the things he says just makes them scratch their heads and question him more. But they're not sincere seekers of truth. They're looking to press him into service. They said therefore unto him, what sign? Okay. And then they added, our fathers did eat manna in the desert, as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Okay, they can't even say anything without needing to be corrected by Jesus. They're quoting from an Old Testament passage, which Jesus then asserts is not about manna at all, but about himself. Bread from heaven is, he says, about me. Verily, verily, I say unto you, Moses didn't give you bread from heaven, but my Father giveth you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he that cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. Then they said unto him, Lord, evermore give us this bread. Okay, we'll go with that. Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me will never hunger. He that believeth on me will never thirst. But I said unto you that ye also have seen me and believe not. Okay. Now, I looked for some time for where Jesus said just that. If he said it, John doesn't record it quite like that. Certainly that is a statement of the fact. They have seen his miracles. They have seen him and yet not believed. But in this previous section, it's not recorded that he said those particular words. In chapter 5, the previous chapter, he said something close. He said, verse 37, and the Father himself, which hath sent me, hath borne witness of me. Ye have never heard his voice at any time, nor seen his shape, and ye have not his word abiding in you. For whom he hath sent, him ye believe not. So there you at least have the expression, you don't believe. But this particular configuration of you have seen, but not believed, you don't, he didn't express it that way here in John. So, verse 37 says then, all that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out. This starts a line of statements here that use this expression of coming to me. And it's very natural for us to take this in the sense that we're coming to Christ as persons or perhaps individuals that were a part of his world, coming to him while he was here on earth. But we have a number of places in Scripture where Jesus uses that language that it is referring to a very literal, physical coming to him on earth. In Mark 10, verse 14, but when Jesus saw it, and it was that they were sending the children away, he was much displeased, and said unto them, suffer the little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of God. In that case, it was clearly them coming to him physically, him receiving them. And then in John, in the next chapter, verse 37, in that last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. And that let is imperative. Do it. If any man thirst, come unto me. No expression of, well, you may not be able to, but so that's literally come now. But in chapter 6 here, there is this whole scenario of where the people are trying to come to Jesus to take him captive to their will. They're trying to make him king. To start with, he went into the mountain. They followed him around, and they're right there in his face. When did you come here? How'd you get here? and these different questions they're engaging in. And so then Jesus, in his speech to them, is evasive and isn't always saying what they think he's saying. And so then, in order to see what he is saying here, there's not a lot that comes in ahead of this that leads us to that, except the fact that we know that they're pursuing him. But it will become more obvious as we read these scriptures. All that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me will I in no wise cast out. For I came down from heaven, not to do mine own will, but the will of him that sent me. Okay, so this gives us some insight into the frame in which Jesus is thinking. The people go on to say, what's he talking about? He came down from heaven. Isn't this the son of Joseph and Mary? Don't we know who this is? But throughout this, the rest of this chapter, Jesus seems to be stepping back, looking at the time whenever he will no longer be here on earth. He says here in a few verses to his disciples who are stumbling over some of the things he said, he said, what if you see the Son of Man ascend up into heaven? Again, where he came from. What if you see that? Will that change things for you? And so some of these verses then have that framework in mind, or that frame of reference in mind. This is the Father's will, which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. So the people are looking here at a man who's doing marvelous things in their eyes, a man they would like to use for their own ends. And Jesus continues to slip through their fingers and insist that he is of a different nature altogether than they anticipate, that he is ultimately beyond their reach. They can't even come to him except the Father make it possible. Not come to hear him here on earth. He's constantly pleading, "Oh Jerusalem, Jerusalem, come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden." The whole appeal of Christ is to come. The call is to come. This is about a conflict, an interaction with those that would use him in a way which is demeaning to him. And his response to them is, "You can't even come to where I am, or where I will be, where I really am." He was here for a very short time. Out of eternity, 3.5 years is not long. And I came down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him that sent me. And verse 40, "And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone that seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life. And I will raise him up at the last day." The verses that we choose to emphasize.
A further fact which supports our confidence that we are in fact understanding what it is Jesus is trying to say here is that this same thread of perspective and its associated language continues in chapters 7 and 8. In chapter 7, we have, "Then Jesus said unto them, Yet a little while am I with you, and then I go unto him that sent me. Ye shall seek me, and shall not find me. And where I am, thither ye cannot come." And then in chapter 8, we have these words, "Then said Jesus again unto them, I go my way, and ye shall seek me, and shall die in your sins. Whether I go, ye cannot come. Then said the Jews, Will he kill himself, because he saith, Whether I go, ye cannot come? And he said unto them, Ye are from beneath, I am from above. Ye are of this world, I am not of this world." Now, in both of these instances, Jesus uses exactly the same Greek word for come, erkomai. And it is very clear in these two instances that he is most certainly thinking about where he will be after he ascends, and that is where we cannot come without the help of the Father. And so John is tracing throughout this section of his gospel this interaction between Jesus and the body of Jews that sort of oscillates between wanting to kill him and wanting to make him king. And in both cases, he very adeptly keeps out of their reach, out of their grasp, distracts them in various ways until he can accomplish all that he came to do here on earth.
The Jews then murmured at him because he said, "I am the bread which came down from heaven." Okay, so they're still chafing because he said to them, "Moses didn't give you any bread from heaven." That made them flare. And so they were muttering about this. They said, "Is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know?" Like, yeah. "How is it then that he saith, 'I came down from heaven'?" And he's already miles beyond them. But he comes back for a moment and says, "Murmur not among yourself. No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day." In light of everything else he said, there's no way that he can be meaning right here and now. The fact is, they did come across the water to him. They came to him. Right? Physically, they were there. But as the God of eternity, he's on earth for a very short time, and he's not at all confined by physical things. And it was way, way, way beyond their capacity to come to him and rope him into their scheme. Not going to happen. And so that's the point that he wants to and needs to make at this point. It's not about, well, you can't even be saved unless you're chosen. No, that's not even on the radar. After all, he just said, "This is the will of the Father, that whosoever seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day." But the thread that I was talking about that's going on behind the scenes here is their intentions to use Jesus to come to him, right? "We'll find you wherever you are," right? "You go up in the mountain, but we'll find you. You go over the sea, don't know how you got here, but we're right up, right behind you." And no, you're not going to do it. You can't do it. I'm in the Father's care. I'm here on his business. And except he allow it, except he bring you to me, you're not going to be where I am. I'm going to be beyond your reach. So hopefully that gives you a little bit better feel for how I came to that conclusion. You have to look at the threads that are underneath the narrative here. Now, another thing of interest, we were kind of stumbling over the language. He says, "Except the Father which hath sent me draw him." And we saw that most every place in the New Testament, that word refers to action on something by somebody else. So the net is drawn in, people are drawn into court, Paul was drawn out of the temple, somebody acting on somebody else, as opposed to just attraction. Well, there's a very interesting thing that happens here. Jesus restates his saying here later in this chapter. So here's the original saying: "No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day." Down here in verse 65, he says, Therefore said I unto you, that no man can come unto me, except it were given unto him of my Father. Well, he didn't say exactly those words, but because he quotes himself in those words, you know they're going to be equivalent to the others. Mm-hmm. So that what he meant by except the Father draw him wasn't some sort of mystical thing. He could have just as well said then, except it were given unto him of my Father. So don't get hung up on the draw word, because it's not critical to what Jesus is trying to communicate. What's critical is that the Father is the agent. It takes God to get you from earth to heaven. But you know, we tend to focus real carefully on exactly which words are used, and that's not all a bad thing. It's just you can overdo it. Sometimes it's not that critical. You're reading too much into it. And here's a case where whenever Jesus quotes himself with slightly different words than he did earlier, you realize, okay, the essence of what he's communicating doesn't depend on that draw word. The essence of what he's communicating is contained in the fact that the Father is the agent involved to get you from one place to the other, and not so much how he does it. So let's follow this a little bit farther. No man can come to me. It is written in the prophets, and they shall be all taught of God. Okay, let me pause here. It may occur to you that, well, there's still a problem with that in verse 44. Because if he's talking about come to him in heaven, then he's already raised up. But you see, there's two different issues here in the minds of the Jews. There's the issue of coming to Jesus, and he says you can't do that. But there's also the issue of what's going to happen at the end of time, at the end of all things, in the last days. And so for Jesus to be claiming to have authority and ability to raise you up at that time is a whole different ballgame. That's a whole different level of conversation. So it's too pedantic to take and say, well, he couldn't be that because this has to happen before that, because that's not what he's doing. He keeps inserting this, and I will raise him up at the last day, to emphasize just what his power is. This is, after all, Jesus of Nazareth going to raise people up at the last day. That's worse than coming, saying you've come down from heaven. You know, he's clearly making claims that boggle the mind unless you understand him to be who he is. Okay. So he goes on then, trying to... Really, it's about distracting them. It is written in the prophets, and they shall be all taught of God. Every man, therefore, that hath heard and hath learned of the Father cometh unto me. Not that any man hath seen the Father, save he which is of God, and hath seen the Father. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that believeth on me hath everlasting life. I am that bread of life. Your fathers did eat manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread that cometh down from heaven, that a man may eat thereof and not die. I am the living bread, which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I give is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world. Okay, so he goes on through these very strong statements in the ears of the listeners, about his flesh and his blood, and they're just really flipping out. And many therefore of his disciples in verse 60, when they heard this, said, "This is a hard saying. Who can hear it?" When Jesus knew it himself, and his disciples murmured at it, he said unto them, "Doth this offend thee? What, and if ye shall see the Son of Man ascend up where he was before?" Okay, so in the mind of Jesus, there's very much this perception of, yeah, I'm here now, but not for long. And you can't come to where I am unless God makes that happen. And unless you believe in me. "It is the Spirit that quickeneth and maketh alive. The flesh profiteth nothing. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. But there are some of you that believe not." There again, not. "There are some of you which the Father hath not chosen." They are totally to blame. It is because of their refusal to trust in him that they are in this position. "For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not, and who should betray him. And he said, Therefore said I unto you, that no man can come into me, except it be given unto him of my Father." Okay, and you know, there again, there is perhaps the surface tendency to say, okay, unless God lets him do it. And think of it as coming to him on earth. But he said too many other things to make it clearly obvious that he does not mean you can't believe on him. He doesn't say you can't believe on me unless the Father draw you, or unless the Father give it to you. He says you can't come to me. That's because of where he's going to be. You can't make that transition. You can't follow him to heaven unless the Father gives it to you, and the Father gives it to those who have believed on him. One more verse here to show you that the kind of terms Jesus is thinking in terms of are such that it would make no sense to talk about the coming to him being coming to be saved. He told his disciples in, I think it's chapter 15, I thought I had it pasted over here, but I don't see it right now. He says, "You haven't chosen me, I've chosen you." So it wasn't an issue of them coming to him anyway. He went out and sought them. He went out and found them. He said, "Follow me." He said, "Follow me." He says to each of us that will listen, "Follow me." If we are going to come to him, to where he is now, it will be because the Father makes it happen. That's my case. And I'd be happy to entertain comments or criticisms, but I think that's where it's at. And I think it's important to recognize that there were times whenever Jesus distracted those who wanted to use him for their own purposes. The truth was there still, but he said things in a way that push them back until it was his time to do what the Father wanted him to do. He was not going to be taken and used for the purposes of men at their will.
What organization wouldn't want him at the head of there?
Yeah.
He did what they wanted him to do.
Yeah, it looks great on the resume. Founded by Jesus Christ, right? So John seems to be very simple in some ways, but he's fairly complicated when you start looking at what he does with his narratives and all the things he brings in. Okay. I think I'm satisfied with that now. This time around. Now, I may study it again next time and learn a lot more. I'm at least satisfied that verse 44 is not an appropriate proof text to prove that God chooses some people to salvation and not others.
Jesus chooses for us, the devil chooses against us, and our choice is the one that determines what it's going to be.
Right. And of course, the logic that they use to make you look like a heretic is that you're saying that the salvation that Jesus provides requires you. And they feel like they have a superior philosophical position because the salvation that they conceive of is totally reliant upon Jesus and has nothing to do with you.
They're responding to the Luther whole scenario of no works, right?
Luther and then Calvin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. But something that perhaps isn't obvious until you start looking carefully at it, for a lot of people, the appeal is that this is a system of theology. It's called systematic theology. And while they often disparage the wisdom of man and the reason of man, it's unbelievable in reading their material how often their final analysis of somebody's position is, that's not very logical. Okay, so this a more logical position, a more logically consistent position is this. Okay. Interesting, you know. So we have ultimately a system which the adherents to feel is superior because it is more logically consistent. And in fact, some of the points of it are derived logically first, and then we go searching for scriptures to make them sound plausible afterwards. But anyway, those that are well versed in it are quite capable of shredding others' ideas. So if you ever encounter it, fasten your seatbelt. They have a label for you.
They're wrong.
They're wrong?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just tell
them. Okay. What would you like to pray about tonight?
People who are traveling.
People who are traveling.
People.
Indeed.
Remember Melinda Boyles' dad.
Okay.
Pretty bad.
Okay.
A prayer of thanksgiving that Larray's continuing to heal.
Okay.
Well, I got a message that Sam's wife got some kind of gallbladder issue or something.
Right. Do you remember her?
It's Kate, isn't it?
Very well. Let's all stand.